Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, all the chips and the BZ. It is Saturday, the 14th of June, Anno Domini 2014. And you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And it's 6 minutes after the hour. It's the Father's Day edition. I know tomorrow's Father's Day, but we're not in the air tomorrow, so shut up about it. We're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. Here comes the news. And before we do that, I should remind you, you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Well, customers using Time Warner Cable, or TWC's Roadrunner email service in cities across the country have been unable to access email for the last few days. Time Warner Cable representatives say that less than 10% of all their customers are affected by the intermittent outages. TWC's website touts having over 15 million customers across 29 states, which means as many as 1.5 million users may have been affected. All this is only affecting residential customer email service. For a large number of internet users, when service for the home is acquired, email accounts for everyone in the home are set up to the internet service provider. Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, and most other internet providers offer the same email services. Complaints have been logged by TWC's Roadrunner customers on Time Warner's online customer service forums, their Facebook page by the hundreds of thousands, and on numerous other user community forums across the internet. When asked for specifics, Time Warner's reps would only state customers in multiple markets are affected, but the issue is intermittent. No information has been provided about the root cause of the Roadrunner email problem, only this statement. Some of our internet customers who use Roadrunner email have been affected by an intermittent issue. Our engineers are working to resolve the issue as soon as possible, and we are sorry for any inconvenience. Similar to this is the statement that appeared across the TWC customer service page. We are experiencing issues with the TWC mail system. We are actively working to troubleshoot and restore access to your email. We thank you for your patience and apologize for the inconvenience. The company's website did not provide any other information regarding Roadrunner email outage, and the customer service representative responding to users in the forum can't offer any solutions to the issue. Time Warner Cable and Comcast Cable had announced a planned merger worth over $45 billion back in February. I'm sure this will not have any impact on that at all.
And then, of course, DirecTV and kind of like AT&T, based off of this merger, said that they were going to merge too.
Yeah, right. So we'll see where that goes. Anyway, our poll of the week at soundbites.org. That's bites with a Y. Francis would like us to remind you is Roadrunner email has had problems this week. And your choices are, I'm going nuts. It's not all that bad. Didn't notice a thing, and who still uses Roadrunner email? So far, we've got 27 people. Number one choice so far is who still uses Roadrunner email. And, of course, I know you'll have more to say about this, so you can head over to the forums, go down the right-hand side of the page. Under Fascinating Stuff, you'll see a link to the forums. The second set is the poll discussion area, and you'll find it under 14 June 14. Roadrunner email has had problems this week. And of course, give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299, toll free 1-800-790-0415.
I thought it was just me.
No, everybody. I can't tell you how many calls I got this week.
Yep.
It appears to be a lot of people, and it's not just the local area. It's your local area. It's much of the West Coast, much of the East Coast, much of the Florida area, all up along the Great Lakes.
See, that implies it's something in the Time Warner backbone. Because every right. region has its own server. So we use pop-server.rochester.r.com. And in Syracuse, it's stny.r.com. Right. So it's all under that r.com, but it's a different server.
Well, it says it's a different server.
True. Different IPs, I've noticed.
Yeah. So I don't know what it is, but man, it's making people really, really, really insane. And it's one of the reasons that you should have, at the very least, multiple email addresses. Perhaps even one of them should be not with your internet service provider.
Yeah, you get a free account from Google or Apple or Yahoo and
right.
have a non-internet service provider related email.
That also makes it easier to change your internet service
provider. Yeah, we hear that a lot from our customers. Well, I've switched from Frontier to Time Warner. How do I change my email address? Well, you don't. You get a new one and tell everyone to start using it.
Right.
And if you're really lucky, they forget to turn off the old one.
Right.
Which I've seen happen for quite a while.
Right. Well, what you really want to do is get that new one now and start forwarding all your email to it. So, for example, if you get a Gmail address, you go into Roadrunner and start forwarding all your mail to that Gmail address. And every time somebody sends you a mail message in the old address, it gets forwarded. So you'll see it at Gmail. But you can also respond and say, remember, stop using this account. The real account is me at gmail.com now.
Right. And one of the things with Roadrunner, especially because they use POP, when you set up Roadrunner to forward, there's a forward and discard option. So it forwards your mail to Gmail and then deletes it from Roadrunner. Otherwise, your Roadrunner mailbox will fill up and you'll stop getting mail, which you may not care. That you stopped getting mail from Roadrunner.
Right, but if everybody starts using your Gmail account or whatever you got.
But people who still send to your Roadrunner account will start getting bounce messages that you're over quota. And the confusion there is a lot of people think that means their own computer. So we get calls all the time that, you know, I deleted all the mail off my computer and I'm still getting an error message that I'm over quota. It's the server that's over quota.
It's not your computer.
Yep.
It's not your computer. It's their computer.
Right, and so you have to go there and delete all that mail.
Yep.
Yeah.
And all Roadrunner is saying now is we're experiencing email troubles with our email.
Yeah, right. That's what they've been saying.
Yeah, a little more than that would help.
Well, sure it would.
It doesn't work. We don't know why. I suppose I don't want to say that.
Right.
We have this issue. We don't really know what's going on. We're trying to figure it out, but we haven't figured it out yet. So please just stand by and bear with us until we can fix this. And if you have anything important that you need to do, oh well.
Somebody pushed a button somewhere that they shouldn't have.
Yeah. I know some people who are Roadrunner staff outside of Rochester. And so I have spoken to them, and a couple of them are very high up in the chain, and they all essentially said the same thing, which we don't have a clue.
Fortunately,
as to what's wrong. I'm paraphrasing, of course.
Yeah.
Their sentence was longer and not suitable for air. Yeah.
But fortunately, Roadrunner internet service is still working.
Right. You can still get internet. You just can't get mail.
Yeah.
So now would be a great time, if you haven't done so already, to go to Gmail or iMail. Or no, that's not what it's called anymore.
iCloud Mail.
iCloud Mail.
Apple Mail, yeah.
Or Apple Mail or Yahoo or any one of those, and set up a free account and then start getting your email, telling people to send email to there. And then because, you know, when you've got somebody as big as Google or Apple, you have less likelihood of a real outage.
Still happens, though, but it's less likely.
It's less likely. And one of the things that someone like Apple or Google can do is they can very easily spin up a whole new server, send everything over to it. You may not have your old mail, but you've got your new mail.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been on Gmail for years now, and I've never experienced an outage, ever. So whatever.
You don't notice it now, because I've looked the Gmail status. You know, last January they had trouble for a few hours, and it was a huge outcry over the internet.
Oh yes, yes.
So many people use it. In fact, I was just logged into my Time Warner account last Saturday when I was here at the show.
Yeah.
Somebody used 18 gigabytes of my internet. So I've got 62 gigs for the month. So Matthew must have been downloading some big updates on his Xbox.
Must have been downloading something. All right. All right.
I can see it. Okay, he's out. Okay, he's out. Go.
Right, Dad's out. I can do what I got. All right. Back to the phones. Our first caller is Larry from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Larry. What's up?
Good afternoon, guys. I have a question for, and it probably pertains to any computer, but again, I've got an iMac. I have Google Chrome that comes up. It's always on when I turn on the machine or boot up. If I put it get off Chrome, close it out, go to sleep, turn it back on, it's off. But if I turn the machine off and turn it back on, Chrome is always on. I don't want it to be on, but I cannot find any place to tell me how to turn it off.
Well, being Apple, there's three places to do it.
Okay.
When you have the Chrome icon in the dock,
right.
You want to right-click on it and go to Options.
Okay.
And uncheck Open at Login. You can tell any program you want to open when you log into your account. So your email, your web browser, things you use a lot, you can do that. And you can accidentally check that on when you're clicking on icons.
Okay, so that's Options, right-click.
Yeah, right-click on the Chrome icon in the dock.
Uh-huh.
And go with Options, and then uncheck Open at Login.
Okay.
You can also go to System Preferences under Accounts,
mm-hmm.
and then Login Items. And that will list all of the things that are set to open at login. And you may be surprised at what's in there. Some programs put themselves in there, like Skype. When you install Skype, it thinks, oh, hey, you want to do this all the time, so I'm going to put myself in your login items.
Okay.
So Skype is almost always stuck in there.
All right.
If you have like Google Drive or Dropbox or one of the cloud syncing services,
uh-huh.
they'll put themselves in your login items so that it can always start running and logging in.
So let's just check if while I'm here. So I'm in System Prefs.
Yep.
And then I check.
And
I go to
under Users and Groups or Accounts, depending on which version you have.
This says Internet Accounts.
No, you want Computer Accounts.
Computer Accounts.
It's got a silhouette of two people on it.
Oh, User Groups is
users
what it's
and
called
groups,
here.
Yep. On some system versions, it's called Accounts. On some, it's Users and Groups.
Okay, so it says user groups. It's got the two people silhouetted.
Yep, you go into that.
Uh-huh.
And then you go into login items on the right, and that shows you all the things that are currently set to open at login.
Oh, there it is.
Yep. So everything is listed there, including faceless apps. So like my Dropbox is there, even though Dropbox isn't an app in my dock, so
uh-huh.
I can't do the right-click thing there. So in your login items in System Preferences is where everything is always listed.
Okay.
And in Windows, it's called Startup Items in the Programs folder, right? And
yeah.
the Start menu. Where is it in Linux? It's a launch agent.
It depends on which version of Linux you're
yeah.
running. It could be any one of a dozen places. It could be in System Startup Items. Could be in something in Startups. I forget what the first one is.
There's Launch Items and Launch Daemons.
Right.
And so yeah, the third place on the Mac is you dig into the Unix layers
right,
and you're under there.
It probably is in the .config folder in your home directory. But
okay.
So it is convenient if you do always want, say, your mail to open every time you turn the computer on. But when something accidentally gets turned on, it's annoying.
And so you can add things to this as well as remove
yep.
things from this as well as just uncheck them, which means they
well,
won't
check,
start.
Well, no, checked means they're hidden when they start. There's a plus and minus at the bottom of the window. So if you
right,
want to actually
looking at that.
Yeah, if you want to remove it from the login items, you hit the minus. And if you want to add something to the login items, you hit the plus.
Ah, got it.
The little checkbox will hide that thing. So it opens but hides the window so you don't see it.
Okay, got it. Well, that solved the problem.
Good.
Thank you guys.
There
yep.
you go.
Uh-huh. Bye bye.
Yeah, you can accidentally turn that on if you said if you right click on an icon in the dock, but if you left click and hold, then you get that options menu again. So if people are trying to click on an icon to launch it and they hold the button down a little too long, it brings the menu up and they can accidentally choose that command.
Right. Because depending on where you are, it might be right near where you were holding the button
yeah,
down.
Yeah, that's also how you can accidentally remove an icon from the dock.
Right.
You click and hold and drag off the dock, and that removes it from
and
the dock.
And it removes it. And to put
in a little puff of smoke, So we see a lot of kids will do that. They'll take everything off the dock
because
they like that puff of smoke. But and so in later system versions, you have to move it farther away from the dock before it removes itself completely.
There you go.
And to put something back into the dock, you find that thing on your desktop. So say you're in your applications folder. If you always use a program, you can then drag it from the applications folder down into the dock.
All right.
It's like the pin to start menu in Windows.
Right. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 20 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites on the truly great and solely member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. I love this story. University of Akron polymer scientists have developed a transparent electrode that could change the face of smartphones literally by making their displays shatterproof. Huh. Nice. I think we all want this.
I thought you were going to say transparent aluminum there.
Yeah.
Hi, Scotty. How do we know he didn't invent the thing?
In a recently published scientific paper, researchers demonstrated how a transparent layer of electrodes on a polymer surface could be extraordinarily tough and flexible, withstanding repeated peeling and bending tests. They call that a scotch tape peeling, where they actually pull the thing right back off the backing. And they could do that over and over and over again, glue it back down, rip it off. Didn't break. This could revolutionize and replace conventional touchscreens, according to Yu Zhu, UA Assistant Professor of Polymer Science. Currently used coatings made of indium tin oxide, or ITO, are more brittle, most likely to shatter, and increasingly costly to manufacture. These two pronounced factors drive the need to substitute ITO with a cost-effective and flexible conductive transparent film, Zhu says, adding that the new film provides the same degree of transparency as ITO, yet offers greater conductivity. The novel film retains its shape and functionality after tests in which it has been bent 1,000 times. Due to its flexibility, the transparent electrode can be fabricated in economical mass quantity rolls rather than flat sheets that are harder to handle and cut and transport and everything else. We expect this film to emerge on the market as a true ITO competitor, Zhu says. This annoying problem of cracked smartphone screens may be solved once and for all with this flexible touch screen. Looking forward to a shatterproof phone? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
Okay, if you hear that screaming sound, that's the sound of executives that took Apple going nuts, that now people aren't going to buy phones because their old phones are cracked.
Right, right.
Yeah, yep.
Well,
or the whole aftermarket replace your screen business.
That's exactly right. You know, people, I know so many people with a cracked screen, both Apple and non-Apple products. I'm not, there's complete parity here. No phone is better. There's no religious issue in this. All screens crack. And unless you get one of those rugged eyes, blah, blah, blah. And even they can crack if you drop them wrong. So having a screen that you can bend, you can put into rolls, you can do whatever you want, also means that all those people who talk about having phones that wrap around your wrist or around your finger, you know, whatever, put them wherever you want to put them, that's going to be a reality at some point, because this polymer, this specialized polymer business will hopefully replace IT.
Yes, we're one step closer to the Futurama-style wrist phone.
Well, yeah, exactly. We've seen wrist phones. We've seen bendable glass. What was it? Andromeda had the little thing that you unrolled like a scroll,
yes.
and that was your screen.
They can do that now.
Yep. That's been science fiction. In fact, I was listening to an episode of This Week in Tech with Jerry Purnell on it. So cool to listen to Jerry Purnell. And he's saying that we science fiction writers are having a heck of a time writing new stories because science fiction is true. Everything we've predicted has pretty much come true. We can't write about anything new.
Can you imagine going to your wrist and lifting this thing up, which then just stands there while you talk to somebody?
Yeah.
Two-way wrist radio, television, Dick Tracy communication. Then you just pop it down and go on your way again.
Yeah.
How freaking cool is that?
Yeah, the pocket computer he wrote about in The Mote in God's Eye is his iPhone.
Yes, it's exactly right.
Yeah.
It used to. What science fiction was it when? I mean, how far away was that when? All the way back to Robert Heinlein, Podcane of Mars, when she had that little pocket thing that she talked to and then and put it back, and it was her lifeline to everything because she could do all stuff. You thought what? How whacked out is Robert Heinlein to think of that? Because that's never.
I remember watching Star Wars and seeing them have these flat phones. I'm like, I can't wait to see one of those. And here, 5 years later, there they are.
Yep.
They're not circular yet, but they may be eventually.
But we'll see that. It's going to happen. We've got this flexible, transparent stuff. If you
and
find
it's because
it online,
of science fiction.
Yes.
That's cool. I saw that in a movie. I want to make that.
Well, and how many of the people who designed the original sets of cell phones said, I was inspired by the communicator on Star Trek. That's why there were flip phones. They did the same thing that Kirk's communicator did.
And almost for the same reason. That was the antenna.
Yes. But and that's what we saw then, and that's what we're seeing now.
Yeah.
You know, if you can roll this stuff out and literally roll it, put it in rolls, and ship it somewhere, that becomes cheaper. If you can cut it like plastic, as opposed to having to etch it like glass, that's cheaper. Everything that this says it can do. Now, it's not on the market yet. Don't go running to the nearest phone store and say, because that's not there yet. But it's coming, and it's coming hopefully fairly soon.
And it's you know, right now the big brand name people know of is Gorilla Glass, extra heavy duty glass, which is still a laminate polymer, right?
Right.
Glass and plastic. You know, it's like typical shatterproof glass in windows and bullet resistant glass. It's a laminate. There's plastic and glass and plastic and glass, and that makes it very very resistant to impact. But it will shatter and spread the impact around instead of reaching completely.
Right.
So when you drop your phone at just the wrong angle.
Right.
I have some strange feeling that when they do fully develop this technology, Apple's going to buy it immediately.
Well, that's
going to
be the next.
They're going to walk up to the owner of this guy and say, yeah, we're going to give you we paid Beats $2 billion. We're going to pay you $3 billion for this.
Well, then there will be a bidding war because Google's going to want it.
And then we're
going to
have exclusivity over.
Yeah.
That can do that.
We've heard rumblings from behind the scenes. Apple doesn't say who their suppliers are, and they don't specifically say they're using Gorilla Glass because that's a Corning trademark,
and
we know that because Corning is local here.
Right.
But we've heard from behind the scenes at Apple. Yeah, they're using Gorilla Glass. Pretty much everybody's using Gorilla Glass.
Yeah.
And it still breaks.
Well, of course it still breaks. If this
not as likely, maybe, but
right. And if you don't think Corning's already put out a thing to this guy and say, why don't you come work for us?
Yeah.
So yes, that could be the new Gorilla Glass. They'll call it Snake Glass because it bends and it does all that stuff. But those are the kind of things that we're starting to see now. What we're coming to is we're kind of bumping it up against the high end of what the current sets of components can actually accomplish. So if we want to get more science fiction-y, we need components that do better things. And listen out there, all you people who are trying to figure out what the next big thing is going to be, I'll tell you what the next big thing is going to be. Go work on it right now. Better batteries.
Material science is a huge, huge thing. In fact, who knew there was a university of polymers?
Yeah.
We want to make better plastic.
Yep.
If you want, you can download the paper that these professors published.
Yeah.
It's not often we quote physics.org as a news source.
But we probably should more often. This is really kind of fascinating. But what we need next are longer-lived batteries. I need a battery that lasts a week of real use.
And can be charged in less than a day.
Oh, and that's... I don't even know if I made that a story here this week, because there were so many things. I didn't. There's a thing going on that a couple of companies are starting to put, Starbucks and places like that, are starting to put charging stations.
Mm-hmm.
In their stores, in their shops.
Yeah.
So when you go, the wireless charging stations, you can just, you know, you're sitting at the table, you drop your phone on the square, and it recharges it.
Yeah.
Well, there's two things wrong with that. One, you have to have a phone that does wireless recharging, of which there aren't that many yet.
And there's several competing standards.
And they picked the wrong standard.
Oh, they did.
90% of the people use a standard that is spelled QI. I don't know how it's pronounced. Qi, 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 qi. I don't know. But they picked a different one. And most of the devices that do inductive charging, the wireless recharging, don't use that standard.
Yep.
So we're going to develop a product that nobody can use.
Well, everybody developed it, and then one became the standard, and it's used in about 90% of those kinds of devices, and Starbucks picked something else.
So that's the Wireless Power Consortium with QI.
Of course, because they had to be different.
The IEEE ratified a standard, of course, from the Power Matters Alliance, which is different. So it's one of the things about standards is there's so many of them to choose from.
Exactly.
And then when one gets ratified as the standard, then you have to figure out which one you're going to use.
Right. I don't think it was PMI. I don't honestly remember. I do not remember who they picked, but it wasn't QI, however that's pronounced. Because it's capital Q, lowercase I. So I'm not sure.
Qi, according to Wikipedia.
Qi. Okay. That was one of my choices. So or one of my choices.
Yeah. What's behind door number one?
But okay.
I was downtown the other day and parked in one of the garages, and the first like half ramp were all charging stations for electric vehicles.
Nice. More and more that's happening. There was actually I was parking one day at RIT. I think I've told this story before. I was parking one day at RIT, and some guy with an electric car was angry because there was a motorcycle parked in what he thought of as his spot. I said, well, if you look closely, that's an electric motorcycle. It's recharging as well. At least it's plugged in. I'm assuming it's an electric motorcycle. Maybe the guy just thought, oh, what the heck? If I've got an extension cord, I can park here.
Yeah.
But
so then you got to bring your duplexer to...
Yeah, right. But yeah, electric cars are getting better and better, and that's why we need better batteries.
Well, was it Tesla this week? Just Elon Musk said he's going to share his battery technology with the rest of the industry.
I love that idea, and he
gets,
his
no one else will probably
battery
use it
technology.
It,
he said he's going to share most of his patents with the rest of the industry to further along the entire industry as a whole.
Yeah, God bless him. The guy's okay. I don't care what anybody says.
He's building a rocket.
He's what?
He's got rockets.
He's got rockets, too.
Space station. They've been delivering stuff to the space station.
He's kind of my hero. I like
Elon
Musk.
I'm just
going
to give my intellectual property away.
Yep. That's right. That's the way it should be.
He is Iron Man. That's, you know, John Favreau says that he patterned Tony Stark, Robert Downey's Tony Stark after Elon Musk.
Yep. The guy's pretty amazing. If you haven't read up about him, M-U-S-K, Elon, E-L-O-N, M-U-S-K, Elon Musk, you should read up on him. He's a pretty cool guy. And the Tesla Motor Company makes, of course, electric cars that get decent mileage. You know, they get a couple hundred miles on a charge. We need that everywhere. Having a car that only gets 30 miles to a charge is okay if you're driving around the city, now that I'm semi-retired.
Commuting back and forth to work, yeah.
And I retire in 16 days, not that I'm counting.
Who's your counter?
Right,
tick-tock, 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 tick-tock.
I could probably get away with on most days a 30 mile range on my car, but most people cannot, you know. And so, and particularly if you're thinking of taking a long trip, you've got to have a second car. But if you've got a car that will Elon Musk's original idea.
You stop along the thruway and swap cars.
You swap batteries out of your car.
Yeah, so that's one of the goals. They want to make charging the car as fast as filling your tank. You know, 5 minutes or so to fill your gas tank.
Right.
And right now, you know, it's an overnight thing to charge your electric car.
What he designed was a battery pack that essentially makes your car a Tonka toy. It's if you turned your car over and replaced the gas tank with a battery,
yep.
That's what he does. And then his idea was you roll up to a service bay, and then a robot pulls your old battery and puts in a new one. You buy the car, but you lease the battery.
Right.
So that you can change it out anywhere you want. And his goal was to get it down to as fast as it takes to fill your tank with gas, which is 3 or 4 minutes. He said, I'd settle for 5. He got it down to 15 seconds of actual getting it out and in. If you're in a line, you're going to wait longer, of course. But so you pull in. It's like pulling into a bay where they're going to lift your car up. You know, you go through the tire guides. You go into the tire guides, and it stops the car automatically. Boom, boom, out you go.
Have you seen all the YouTube videos of the people missing the guides and falling into the pit? Yeah. Hundreds of them.
That is an issue. Oh my heavens, I rarely ever wash my car because God does it for me often enough. But, at least in the summer. But I was behind someone. I don't know if it was a man or a woman or a child or an adult or I don't know what it was. But it was somebody ahead of me in the car wash. And it had to be 5 minutes. It seemed like half an hour finally, it took three people to line this person up. They stopped for the guy would wave, make him back up, do it again, make him back up, do it again. And these things have big, wide guides. It's hard. Apparently, they were bumping up over the guide every time.
How do you get into that predicament to start with? I don't understand how that would happen. You would think that you would just drive straight ahead. It would go right into the thing.
Yes.
And away you go.
Yes, you would certainly think so.
But apparently that's not what happened here.
And I was behind him, and I just found it, I wasn't in a hurry to get anywhere, so I just found it hysterical watching this poor person, and I never saw the person. I don't know anything about the person. But the three people who were eventually, I swear they were thinking, let's just get everybody together, pick up the car, put it in the guides, and go on from there.
Last week was Fairport Canal Days, and so the village was a zoo, parking was horrible. So I'm dropping the family off.
Right.
So I drive all the way up to the barricade to drop them off. And as we're going up 250, we see this lady in a bright red car, of course, trying to parallel park and couldn't and couldn't and couldn't and couldn't. Finally, she got far enough into the spot, still nosed out into the street, that we could get around her. So then I go all the way up into the village, drop everyone off, and as I'm heading back home, she's still there. She's got her kids out now waving at her.
Parallel parking is not a skill that we practice very often.
And I think it was a Prius with a rear camera, right?
Yeah, right.
Most new cars now have a rear camera.
Well, the other thing
is they'll park themselves.
Right. The other thing is that people don't know how long their cars are.
Yeah.
I drive a very short car. I drive a Cube. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm coming along, if somebody in like a an SUV pulls out of a spot or even a regular size car,
you don't have to
spot.
Parallel. You just go in.
I just go in. That's absolutely correct. But back in the day when I was driving a tank, I drove a Chevy Bel Air. The hood was so big, I always expected 22 guys to come out and play football on it. It was just enormous. But I used to parallel park all the time because that was the only place in Hudson, New York that was the only way you could park was parallel. So I got good at not only parallel parking, but parallel parking on either side of the street. Because I discovered that behind the place I was living was a one-way street, and you could parallel park both sides. That's and so I got really good at parallel parking on the right. I mean, really good, because most people didn't, because they couldn't do it.
But back to Elon Musk for a minute. He is a geek. His blog post where he told everyone he's doing this, all our patents belong to you.
He's a funny guy, and I admire him. I do. All right. You know what? We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 42 minutes after the hour. Give us a call and join in the fun. 966-5299, 800-790-0415. We'll be back with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. Sound Bites on the solely member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And in 46 minutes after the hour, we are sound bites, and you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 1-800-790-0415. And I love this statistic. 47% of all U.S. households subscribe to Netflix, Hulu Plus, Amazon Prime, or a combination of these services. And 49% of all households have at least one TV connected to the internet. This is according to a new study from the Leichtman Research Group about emerging video services. 4 years ago, only 24% of all households had an internet-connected TV. That combination of connected TVs and internet video subscriptions is increasingly shaping what we are watching. 49% of all Netflix subscribers watch online video programming on a connected device every week, compared to only 8% of viewers who don't subscribe to Netflix. And 78% of all Netflix subscribers watch their videos on a TV. 34% of the people quizzed for this study said that they watch online video every day, and 61% do so every week. 34% every day, 61% every week. The big and hotly debated question is, once again, what effect does all of this have on cable TV? Netflix CEO Reed Hastings has said time and time again that his company's service is complementary to and not replacing digital pay TV, but the Leichtman research numbers seem to suggest that this is starting to change. In 2010, 88% of Netflix subscribers also had pay TV. Fast forward to 2014, a mere 4 years later, that number is down to 80%. So they lost 8% in 4 years. That's 2% a year. That's a lot of people when you figure how many people have televisions. At the same time, the number of cord cutters who also subscribe to Netflix is rising from 16% in 2010 to 48% in 2014. Leichtman's numbers are echoed by a recent Consumer Electronics Association, CEA, study about the market for U.S. television services. 45% of all U.S. TV households watch internet content on their TVs, according to that study. Use of internet TV programming steeply increased from 28% in 2013. Only 5 million U.S. household, U.S. TV households rely exclusively on internet TV, according to the CEA. But 10% of all TV households said they're likely to cancel that service in the next 10 months. Altogether, a total of 17 million TV households already don't subscribe to traditional pay TV, but instead rely on antennas, the internet, or a combination of both for TV programming. So, how have your viewing habits changed, particularly if you're a cord cutter? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
We're seeing a lot of the 20-somethings now as they get their own apartments. Don't bother with cable TV. Everything's internet. It's like the transition from landlines to cell phones.
Right.
A lot of people have stopped having landlines because I've got my cell phone. Why do I need to pay for another phone?
If you've got any one of the streaming services like Netflix or Amazon Prime or Hulu Plus, or in fact all of them, that's still only about $25 a month. Plus, almost every station has a watch me later sort of,
yep.
You know, you can see.
If not the website, then they have a mobile app.
Right, right, where what you can see yesterday's TV show today. Yep. So you can't talk about it in the morning around the water cooler, but you can talk about it the day after.
And already that's already been common with most people DVRing things these days. You know, I haven't seen last week's whatever, so don't talk about it
yeah,
yet.
Yeah, don't tell me anything.
And binge yep. watching, which got so popular on Netflix. You know, I want to watch the whole season. excuse me, I read a an article about the on-demand services that typically, you know, on your cable TV, you can go back for maybe five episodes of a show. But say you don't realize it's a good show, or you didn't find out about it until halfway through the season. So more and more of the on-demand are letting you go back the whole season.
Yeah,
because then maybe you'll keep subscribing.
Well, that's exactly right, and you're right. When House of Cards was announced, when Orange is the New Black was announced, these were all shows that became binge watch shows.
Yeah.
They released them all at once, and people binged through the whole series.
And they can still have cliffhangers, and oh my goodness, I have to go to bed now, but I don't want to. So I've got this 15 hours of TV show I want to watch.
Right, right, right. And you can do that now so often, and particularly with a lot of old shows. I just watched the entire run of Fawlty Towers.
Oh, Basil!
Exactly. The entire run is on Netflix. I watched the whole thing. I got a little tired of it after. So I didn't watch it all in one binge sitting, but I could do that. I could do that with a whole bunch of old shows. And it was great. I just, my pet peeve for that stuff is that there isn't enough of the old shows that I want to watch available and on demand.
But there is a lot of it. You're browsing through Netflix. Oh, I remember that. I want to watch it. Oh, that was good too. Let's watch that again.
And sometimes you go, I like that. What was I thinking?
Hey, it was the 80s.
You're right. So I didn't do a lot of thinking back then, absolutely. Yeah. All right, our next caller is Dennis from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Dennis. What's up?
Hi. I'm a little confused. You guys were talking about set-top boxes last week and Netflix and this week again. I realize I can't go to Blockbuster anymore and get DVDs. I got to go to whatever that thing is, Redbox, and there's not the availability of movies that I'd like to see, especially like some older ones from 10 years ago or whatever.
Right.
So I'm confused. I was thinking of signing up with Netflix so I could watch stuff on TV. So I think you mentioned different names of set-top boxes that would include Netflix. Am I correct on that?
Pretty much every set-top box includes Netflix. So Netflix by itself is an internet service for watching movies and TV shows.
Well, but it's more than an internet service because through Netflix you can also order DVDs. So things that are not available as streaming are available as DVDs that they will send to your home.
Which are getting less common to have a physical disc.
But you can still do it.
Right.
What are the names of the boxes? Name a few different choices.
The big one that everybody knows is called Roku. R-O-K-U.
R-O-K-U. Roku. Okay.
That's a great set-top box. I had one. I don't anymore, and here's why. I'm still paying for one. No, I'm not paying for it. Once you own it, it's yours. I bought a Blu-ray DVD player, which included Netflix and Hulu Plus and Amazon Prime and about 1,000 other things. So I didn't need the Roku box anymore, so my daughter promptly stole it and took it to college.
The other major boxes are the Apple TV box.
Did you say Opera?
Apple TV.
Apple TV, okay.
It also has Netflix and YouTube and a bunch of other channels.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much every box will have Netflix, YouTube, and Hulu and a few channels. And then they have their own custom stuff. So Apple's box has the iTunes store. So if you buy stuff there, it's available. Now Amazon just released their Fire TV box, which gives you Amazon Prime streaming. So there's sort of two halves of the puzzle. There's the streaming service, Netflix and Hulu, Amazon Prime. And then there's the box you plug into your television to get that streaming service.
Okay.
And a lot of the newer TVs and DVD players now and Blu-ray players will have one or more of the streaming services built in to that Blu-ray player or that television, so you don't need a separate box.
Okay. Right. Well, no, I've got Amazon Prime, and I haven't paid attention to that streaming thing because I really don't want to watch movies on my computer. So do I have to buy the Fire TV box in order to get the Amazon streaming, which I'm...
Or you connect your computer to your television and use the television as a monitor.
Right, but the Chromecast, the Roku, the Apple TV, the Fire TV, all of them have Amazon Prime.
Apple doesn't have Amazon.
Oh, all right. But Roku certainly has Amazon Prime.
Okay, and lastly, you mentioned their DVD player. So could I buy a DVD player that would have all that stuff instead of buying the set-top box? Because I could
absolutely.
Use a DVD. Yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah, most.
Mine was a Sony. It was about $150, but you know you that's usually, just what I happen to buy.
You usually pay a little more because it's a smart player,
right,
or a
right,
smart
right.
TV has the internet. That's what a smart TV or smart Blu-ray player is. It has internet services as part of it.
Does it have to be Blu-ray?
No, well, you go take a look. There are a dozen manufacturers.
I don't think anyone makes a plain DVD player anymore.
I don't think so either anymore.
Okay.
But a plain a Blu-ray will play plain DVDs.
I'm sorry, say again, please.
A Blu-ray player will also play regular DVDs.
Oh, okay.
So that's just, you know, it's like any of the new things are backward compatible. So
if I'm at a big box store or whatever and I'm looking for a DVD player, it's going to say that it's capable of doing X, Y, and Z.
Oh, it'll say it right on the box.
It'll be right on the box. It'll be like a logo
on the box
to Amazon.
Yep. One of the tricks they do, though, is some of them need an Ethernet connection to get to the Internet.
Right.
And the slightly more expensive ones will have a wireless connection. So it has Wi-Fi built into the player, so you don't need to run an Ethernet line to your television.
I got DSL, so wireless.
Well, and so do I. And so it has wireless, and so my Blu-ray player is wireless, although it's sitting right next to it.
Mine I got a couple years ago is only wired, so I've never gotten around to running a wire to the television.
Yeah, mine's too. Mine is too, and mine's wired to the television from my Frontier DSL router, which I have a ways away a little bit, so.
Well, it sounds like since I kind of really need a DVD player, I mean, I have an old VCR DVD combo thing. Since I need a DVD player, it sounds like my best bet is just to go and get a DVD player that does all this other stuff instead of just a set-top box.
Listen, let me give you a little bit of advice. Make sure you've got plenty of time when you go shopping because the options are amazing.
Okay.
But you will find many, many players, DVD, Blu-ray players, that have all of these things, and pick out the ones you want: Amazon Prime, Netflix, YouTube, Hulu, whatever.
And I posted an article from Forbes comparing a bunch of the different boxes.
Oh,
and they have a nice chart about what each box is and what services they have.
Is that on your thing? Did you post that today?
Yep, just a few minutes ago.
Cool. I don't suppose you guys would know which person of interest, what series, what. That would be that's in Channel 8 in Rochester.
Yeah, Person of Interest, as I recall,
I don't remember,
is available on, what is it, CBS or NBC or whichever one
on
is
their,
it's on
CBS.
Their website.
Yeah, on their website or on their app. There's also a website called canistream.it that you put in your show or movie and it will tell you where it's available.
I got the Can I Stream. I didn't get the last part.
Can I Stream .it.
IT?
.it. Yes, Italy, but Can I
Stream. Oh, okay.
So Can I Stream .it. Can I Stream it?
Can I Stream it? Yeah.
Great. Thanks, guys.
All right, thanks.
So Netflix and Hulu. Netflix seems to be on every box. Hulu is on almost every box. Amazon is on some boxes, so they're fighting back and forth.
Right. So it's just a matter of finding which one you like. And then something like Chromecast... You can go to your Chromebook or whatever, and forward that to your TV.
Yeah,
through the
of
Chromecast,
them.
And so whatever you can
the only,
stream.
The only drawback to the Chromecast is because I have one now. There seems to be a small bit of like a 2 or 3 second delay between what's playing on your computer or mobile device and what's playing on the actual television. And occasionally, and I've had it happen to me, the connection between the Chromecast player and the router will be dropped.
Okay.
Occasionally. So there are some small drawbacks to the Chromecast system.
Good to know. Thank you. All right. That makes sense. Like I said, before I got my DVR player, my DVD player, and my daughter stole my Roku box, I loved that Roku box. It was inexpensive, and it did everything, fast.
Roku is kind of known for the weird channels.
You've got
the Hong Kong cinema that you like.
That I like so much.
Yep.
I have El Rey Network now, so.
Yeah.
Well, oddly, you seem to have wasted an entire hour of your life listening to this show. Don't worry, though. We're going to give you an opportunity to do it again on the other side of what's coming up. But we will be back for a whole nother hour with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 1 p.m., and we will be back with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's right. You're listening to Soundbites, and we're right here on the truly great, and I don't think we can say this often enough, solely member-supported Jazz 90.1. Stay tuned. We'll be right back to do this all over again.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, we are hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's right. You're listening to Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. This is one of those stories that makes me depressed because it's about whiz kids who are 14. A couple of 14-year-old computer whizzes, actually not that much of a whiz when you listen to the story. A couple of 14-year-old computer whizzes have the Bank of Montreal upgrading their security measures after they hacked an ATM machine. Matthew Hewlett and Caleb Turan, both grade 9 students, found an old ATM operator's manual online that showed them how to get into the machine's operator mode. On Wednesday, over their lunch hour, they went to a Bank of Montreal ATM to see if they could get into the system. We thought it would be fun to try it, but we were not expecting it to work, Hewlett said. When it did, it asked for a password. Hewlett and Turan were even more shocked when their first random guess at the 6-digit password worked.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
They used a common default password. The boys then immediately went to notify the bank of the breach. When they told the staff about a security problem with an ATM, they assumed one of their PIN numbers had been stolen, Hewlett said. I said, no. We hacked your ATM. We got into the operator mode, Hewlett said. He said that it wasn't really possible and we don't have any proof that we did. I asked them, is it all right for us to get proof? He said, yeah, sure, but you'll never be able to get anything out of it. So we both went back to the ATM, and I got into the operator mode again. Then I started printing off documentation, like how much money is currently in the machine, how many withdrawals have happened that day, how much it's made off of surcharges. Then I found a way to change the surcharge amount, so I changed the surcharge amount to 1 cent. As further proof, Hewlett playfully changed the ATM's greeting from welcome to the BMO ATM to go away, this ATM has been hacked. They returned to BMO with 6 printed documents. This time, staff took them seriously.
They called the police, right? We're security experts. We're not thieves.
Yeah. They brought the branch manager out to talk to us, he said. He was quite concerned and said he would have to contact the head of security. Hewlett and Turan had a concern of their own. They were late for school. So Turan asked for a note on BMO letterhead explaining their tardiness. His request was granted by the bank's financial services coordinator. Please excuse Mr. Caleb Turan and Matthew Hewlett for being late during their lunch hour due to assisting BMO with security, the note began. Not surprisingly, the note raised eyebrows when it was presented at school. So do you still trust ATMs? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415.
Okay, first of all, how does an ATM operating manual get online? Second of all, how does a current ATM operating manual get online? And third, why was the password for an ATM at the Bank of Montreal, which is a major, major, major bank up there and down here to an extent, why was that the default? Why did they stay with the default password?
Yeah, these are all really, really good questions. It was just...
And people... And then they wonder why people don't trust banks.
Exactly.
Well, I've seen TV news specials, you know, John Stossel in his news special, where they'll put an ATM in the middle of the street and watch people stick their PIN in it. Well, and then they go up. Well, do you know whose ATM that is? No. Is there a bank logo on it? No. Why'd you use it? I needed some money.
Yep.
Well, you just gave us your PIN number, and now we can steal all the money out of your account.
That's right.
And then they went to there's companies that sell used ATMs, and they bought a bunch of them, and the print roll inside the ATM was still in there with all the transaction lists and code numbers and bank account numbers still in the machine. So it's getting common now for little stores to put an ATM in. It's a nice source of income with that surcharge fee. And you got to trust where it's coming from and where it's going.
Yeah, that's not a major bank. Yeah. I mean, this is a major bank. This is Canada's version of like Bank of America.
Yeah,
think that they would know the heck they were doing.
We were in Niagara Falls, Canada one day years ago, you know, walking up and down the touristy road there, whatever it is. And it was a Sunday afternoon, I think, and there were a bunch of guys outside an ATM with construction tools. And part of me is thinking, they're robbing that ATM in broad daylight.
Yep.
Because everyone just ignored them. Oh, they're, you know, it's their maintenance or they're doing something. No,
nobody knows who they are. I've always said this. If you walk in dressed like a workman with a bunch of tools,
and a clipboard,
or you wear a tie and a white shirt and carry a clipboard, no one will ever stop you. Ever. Everybody assumes you're supposed to be there. And you got to have the attitude.
Yeah, hi, I'm Joe from security. We're doing a random sweep here. We need your password.
I used to do that all the time. We would hire students, right? Clearly college student age. They're students. They're clearly students. And the first day I would send them down to our labs just to take equipment out.
Yep.
And see if anybody stopped them or asked them anything. 9 times out of 10, they did not. And then I would complain to the people who were running the labs, say, your people are not doing their job. But yeah, you got to, it's kind of ridiculous. It's kind of ridiculous. Where was I? It doesn't matter. But I saw an ATM. I went up to it, and I suddenly thought to myself, I don't see a bank logo. I see nothing here. There's just a thing on the screen that says press enter to begin. So I did. There was still no bank information. There was nothing. I eventually asked the manager, and he said, yeah, we know that's there. It's ours. It's legit, blah, blah, blah. It's whatever network it was. I said, well, there ought to be something on there that names a bank at least, at the very least. But yeah, it was, I hesitated.
You stick your card into some random slot somewhere?
Exactly. Not my style.
And that's how the skimmers work. Someone will go along to a legitimate ATM or gas machine or something, and they'll put a card reader on it so they can read your card while you're putting it into the legitimate reader.
At the Hess station up the street from us, my mother was in the station up there, and she was going to get money out of this ATM. Well, there was a guy in front of her that was getting money out of that ATM. The guy put his code in and asked for the money. He got a withdrawal slip. He didn't get any cash.
Ooh.
Supposedly it was, he didn't say how much money it was, but supposedly it was over $50.
Wow.
My mother looked at him, turned around, walked out. I mean, I that's at a Hess station.
Yep. Yep.
It ate his money.
Yeah. My bank now has little shields, little green glass shields around where you put the card in and
type your PIN. Although a lot of those new ones now, the shields make it hard to type.
Well, in fact, I didn't do it the first time.
Yeah.
I drove up to that. I looked at it and I thought, I don't recognize what this is about. And I drove away and I called the bank the next day and I said, what's the deal? I said, oh, we just put those in. You're the only person who's called. Really? If I go up to an ATM and it's suddenly got this thing all over it where I'm going to put my credit card and type in my PIN, I'm going to stop and think twice.
Yeah. I read once about probably the guys have the biggest cojones they've ever found. They bought an ATM and went to a mall and said, can we put an ATM in the mall? We'll give you $2 from every transaction. They put some money into it, so it wasn't suspicious, and collected PIN numbers for a month.
Nice.
And then went on a $10 million shopping spree.
Absolutely, they would. Absolutely. These ATMs are very...
We're from Joe's Bank. We want to put an ATM in your... Oh, sure.
I'm old enough to remember when nobody used an ATM,
yep,
and they actually randomly gave away an extra $20 if you used the ATM. Each ATM was programmed to give one extra $20 bill a day.
That's like today's credit card systems. If you use this card instead of cash, you get this extra this.
Right. But the point was, because nobody had seen ATMs before and people were leery of it and they wanted that human interaction, people did not use ATMs. And so in order to let people do that, they made it known that these machines would randomly give out extra money.
I remember.
I never used a human teller again.
I remember an old version of Dragnet where they had a great scam. The night deposit at the bank, right? Somebody put a cardboard box saying night deposit broken, put your deposits here. And people did. We're programmed to obey signs.
So the next
morning, the guy would go before the bank opened. He'd take the cash out, but in the end of the show, when they caught him, he said he put the checks and deposits in the night deposit. He just only took the cash.
I'm not even sure how that's illegal. I suppose the sign said the night deposit was broken and it wasn't.
Yeah.
But if you, it's
fraud,
like soupy sales.
Some sort of fraud, yeah.
Go in your parents' wallets, take out the thing, pieces of paper that look like this, and send them to me. I'm not entirely certain that's illegal.
Yeah.
He's only asking you to do something, and if you do it, you did it voluntarily.
Yeah.
Yep.
So can they fault you for being...
Well, the thing that gets
me... Stupid's the wrong word.
Yeah.
but
hi, stranger. Yes, I'll give you my money.
Too trusting is how that works. Here's the thing. It's the same thing with all those games and little things that people, what's your mafia name or what's your elf name or whatever. They're asking you for your name, your date of birth.
Yep.
Well... those are two things they need to steal your identity.
Mm-hmm.
How many of those things are stealing your identity, and how many of those things are actually legit? I never do one of those because I never want people to know what my birthday is.
Yeah.
It's none of your business. All of that information, it's none of your business. All right.
I had that the other day. It was supposedly someone from a financial company, and they wanted my address. Well, shouldn't you know my address? And then they wanted my Social Security number. Well, shouldn't you know my Social? They're just trying to verify I'm me.
Yeah,
well,
right.
How about you verify that you're you?
Right. All right, back to the phones. Tim from Webster, New York. Hiya, Tim. What's up?
Yeah, hi, guys. That was cool information there about that Mr. Musk. I had never heard of him before, and I'm going to research him. I think that I'm waiting for a quick charging electrical car to come out. So that's just really neat. My question is, I bought a new computer about 6 months ago. It was my second Acer, and my previous Acer was from about 3 years previous. And they've made a pretty drastic change with the keyboard, whereby there's a raised surface next to all the keys, as compared to the older version here, where there's a much more sunken down surface. And that's what my question is. With this three-year-old computer now, I've got loads and loads of dust in there. And I didn't want to take one of those air cans to it because I was afraid I might make it worse and, like, embed the dust in there worse. I was just looking for suggestions.
So this is a laptop.
Yeah, a laptop.
And there's a raised surface next to all the keys, and it's collecting dust?
No, well, the raised surface is the new one, so it prevents that dust from accumulating. And the old surface on my old computer doesn't have it. It's like they recognized, oh, people are getting tons of dust embedded under their keys, so we'll raise the surface up.
Yeah, we like to recommend little rubber keyboard guards that prevent dust and dirt and spills from getting down inside the keyboard.
There are two things that are generally recommend. Well, three things. Nobody expects Spanish Inquisition. One is there's a putty that you can buy that is designed specifically for this. You spread it out over the keys, and when you lift it out, all the crud around it comes out. You can also do that with Post-it notes. Stick the sticky side of the Post-it note down in there. And it also will pick up much of the dirt and stuff. But the only real way to clean it is to take the keyboard right off and then clean it that way, blow it out or whatever it is you're going to do.
And
obviously on a laptop, that's not terribly easy.
And using a vacuum is much better than using a blower dust, which will just blow it down in. You're better off with a vacuum and specifically a non-conductive computer vacuum.
There you go, because any of those standard little vacuums can cause a lot of static and destroy your machine. But the special ones that are designed specifically to use on a computer are non-conductive and won't have that issue.
Do you have any idea what... I've never even heard of such a thing. Do you know what that might cost? What those might cost?
The non-conductive...
Yeah.
You know what? I don't.
Quick search of Amazon. I found a website at How to Geek on cleaning, and they have a toothbrush, Q-tips, and isopropyl alcohol.
Okay, here's... I just found one vacuum for computer at Amazon, and it's horribly slow coming up, so...
Okay.
I got...
The electronic stores usually have them.
This is a big one for $70. There's also a smaller one for $60. Here's one, the mini vacuum cleaner for $3. Here's one for $14. Yeah. So
Staples
24
and Office
bucks.
Max have them. Office Depot. Oh, yeah, okay. So just Google computer vacuum, you'll find them.
So the idea is, because I was wondering if I might want to take a really tiny paintbrush to it. I was thinking maybe upside down, but you think maybe that'll just embed the dust in there worse?
But the bristles could generate static.
Oh.
So you want a non-static bristle.
Right.
Okay.
And even a Q-tip and alcohol, the cotton can fluff off and get down inside the keys too.
Right, and... I'm willing to go to these lengths and the putty and everything. I'm just looking for something that I was hoping would be. I thought you guys would say, yeah, there's this thing you can use and it'll take 2 seconds, but it looks like it's going to have to be a little labor intensive.
Don't get it dirty in the first place.
Right. Like I said, you can try. Some people have had success at least getting out a majority of this stuff with Post-it notes, sticking the sticky side in.
Okay. Well, I'm writing all these notes down on Post-it notes, so I'll put them to use. Okay, thanks for your time, guys.
Yep, thank you.
Think Geek has the CyberClean Electronics Cleaning Putty.
That's the stuff that I was talking about earlier.
Out of stock.
Well, but everybody can find Think Geek. All right, listen, we're going to take another quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. Give us a call, 966-5299, 800-790-0415. 22 minutes after the hour, Soundbites, member-supported, Jazz 90.1.
Got a computer question? Call the boys now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or toll free 800-790-0415. Online at soundbites.org. Soundbites continues next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 26 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And we wasted...
And I hate you.
...that entire... we wasted that entire break looking at thisiswhyimbroke.com, which really, you do not want to go there. Okay, today, Apple made ear pods that come nestled in the box of every new iPhone, He's a regular old 3.5-millimeter headphone jack. That means you can use them with any other device with a 3.5-millimeter audio port. It also means you can use virtually any other pair of non-Apple headphones with your iPhone. A quietly updated spec to Apple's Made for iPhone or MFI standard suggests that may soon change. According to people who have seen the spec, Apple has modified the MFI standard to include headphones that connect to iOS devices via the Lightning port instead of the headphone jack. The implications are huge, particularly with audiophiles and app makers. Headphones connecting through the Lightning port will be able to receive lossless 48K digital audio, as well as send mono 48K digital audio input through a mic, should they have one. As with today's 3.5-millimeter headphones, manufacturers will be able to build in remote volume and control playback into the headphones too. But that's just the beginning. The port switch could also mean headphones could be made to work exclusively with a particular app, or even launch a specific app once they're plugged in. Headphone makers will also be able to make active noise-canceling headphones without needing an external battery. So imagine this, because we need one more thing to drain our iPhone batteries. So imagine this, instead of being able to plug in your AirPods and listen to whatever streaming music app you want, a pair of future AirPods could only work with the iOS music app and iTunes Radio or Beats Music. The same could equally be true of third-party headphones and apps too, of course. Using the Lightning port has a few advantages for audiophiles as well. Stu Lumsden, Vice President of Engineering for Polk Audio, says there would be no degradation due to the quality of the analog electronics used in the output section of the iPhone. Impedance mismatching, which is a problem that causes changes to the intended headphone response, is also avoided, as is high-frequency analog signal loss in the cable. Essentially, the headphone designer can choose the best DAC, DSP, and amp they want for the price point of the product, that is. On the negative side, using headphones to plug into the Lightning connector mean you can't listen and charge at the same time if that's something you ever need to do. Could this spec mean that Apple's going to ditch the 3.5-millimeter jack in future iOS devices? Not likely. Apple has developed a rich third-party accessory ecosystem and wants the iPhone to be the center of your connected device life, something that we talk about all the time. Suddenly, dropping support for traditional headphones and earbuds would do more damage than good in this respect, although that's not to say that Apple may eventually ditch the old 3.5-millimeter jack at some point in the future. While Apple has already introduced this new standard, it doesn't quite work yet. The company needs to enable the feature, which could be done as soon as iOS 7.1, whenever that ships. Is this a good idea or a disaster in the making? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
I vote disaster in the making, because if Apple does eventually get rid of the regular headphone port, they're just further isolating themselves.
Yep.
Well, from every other brand imaginable.
Right. They're isolating themselves, but more importantly, if you can, in fact, match a headset to an app, everybody's going to want to make that extra money by bringing out their own headset.
Yeah.
Which means you got to have 15 different headsets.
Which is more of a reason why they wouldn't do it.
Well, just because you say that.
Yeah.
You know, if you're Pandora.
With the Pandora headphones, yeah.
You might want to put out a pair of headphones that also lets you say, add track. I like this.
Yep.
Whatever it might happen to be, you know?
Or skip ads or something.
Right.
But so. the audio industry has been using the docking port for microphone and recording connections for a long time. The headphone jack is we mentioned last week, is a very, very old standard. And it's analog. So one of the ironies is that we've got digital music. Okay, yeah, it's crappy compression maybe. But then it goes back to analog to get into your speakers. So
right. If
we have digital speakers, why not use the digital connection and not have that DAC to AC loss?
On the other hand, you're still listening to crappy MP3s.
Yeah.
All right, to the phones. Gary from Greece, New York. Welcome, Gary. What's up?
Well, first of all, I am a donor to the show. So
I love to hear that.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Second of all, I have an old Dell computer. It's a it's a desktop, and it used to run XP, and I put Ubuntu on it. way back when Oneirik was the version that was out.
Right.
And then it said that I should do an upgrade to whatever the next level was.
Right.
And I tried to do it. And this is a basic machine, just entry level, whatever video card is on the motherboard, that's what
right.
I have. So I went to do the upgrade, and it said, oh, my God, we don't have a driver for your video card.
Mm.
So it said, you can do this at your own risk, or maybe not, or wait a few months, and maybe it'll come up. So I didn't do it, and then later on, I went and went through the same thing. And by this time, I had at least two, maybe three upgrades to do. And you have to do them sequentially. So I said, yeah, what the heck, I'll give it a try. And I got the next version, and now it can't run its desktop. It's only a command line, and I don't know what to do from here.
Oof. okay. There are a couple of choices. One is, of course, to buy a video card. Do you know what kind of video card it is?
Well, it's whatever's on the motherboard, so I think it's NVIDIA.
Okay, there are a couple of different NVIDIA drivers.
Generic drivers that work, but not necessarily specific for that card.
Right, there's a binary NVIDIA driver, which is not installed by default because it is proprietary. Here's the deal with these things. Most Linux versions do not install proprietary software. That doesn't mean that it's for sale. They're not stealing it. It's still open. It's still free to use. It's not open source because they don't give you the source code. So you can still install it. If you did a search for NVIDIA, you would see the binary driver in the list.
And it would help to check your computer's manual to see exactly which NVIDIA chipset it is.
Oh, this manual is not that detailed.
You may have to go to their website then.
Yeah.
Right. So you could do that. That's how to install. What version of Ubuntu did you upgrade to? 13 something?
The one after Oneirik. I think it was 12.
Oh, that could certainly explain it. Wow, because they're up to 14 now.
Yeah. Should I just do a fresh install? Just download it and try.
Well, you're going to lose whatever you got there, right?
Well, I have almost nothing on the computer, so.
Well, then I might suggest you download and burn a fresh CD and try that. And it may give you the option of, because I also have an NVIDIA card and I also have Ubuntu on a desktop, and I use the binary Ubuntu driver, and it works exceptionally well. Actually.
So where do I search for that driver?
Well, generally, now the way it worked for me is when I installed it, it asked me if I wanted to use the proprietary driver during the installation. It's just one of those things you got to read.
Okay. It didn't give me that offer when I tried to do the upgrade.
Okay. Not when you do the upgrade, because it's assuming you already made a decision the last time you did it, and therefore just gives you what you had before. Right, but theoretically, at least, this should work. There are a number of them. They're basically NVIDIA-graphics-drivers, and then whatever the latest number is, which I think is 331, but I can't promise that. They also have Nouveau. That's the other one. That's the one it normally is using. If you were to look through your system for Nouveau drivers, N-O-U-V-E-A-U, the French spelling of Nouveau, you would probably find that that's what's installed. That doesn't do 3D acceleration. It doesn't work with some types of NVIDIA cards, but it is fully open source. If you have an onboard graphics chipset, there's a whole separate set of things that you can do with this. But at any rate, yeah, we'll post that. There's also something. No, I don't know that that's going to work. Anyway, start. We're going to post a document on how to.
I had the previous one that had the list.
Okay, good. Steve has posted something on that page. There is also a link to another article for onboard graphics chipsets, and you should read that as well.
Okay, so that'll go on soundbites.org?
Yes, that should be there right now at the moment, at least.
Yep.
It should be the top story.
Okay. Look there.
But it's called Binary Driver How-To/NVIDIA-Community-Help-Wiki.
Yes, I see it.
There you go.
Okay. Have you got time for a separate question?
Yeah, go for it.
I have Yahoo Mail, and I use the web browser version of it, and I leave all my mail up on the server, and I never actually download it, and I don't have it turned on to use PopMail or whatever other
right.
there is. Don't have that. But when I look around on my hard disk, I keep accumulating these .eml files, which have my email in it.
Right.
So how does it get there?
Somewhere in because you're using the webmail version.
Yes.
So it's caching.
It's got
to
be caching.
When you go to the website, it downloads everything on that website to your computer anyway, so it can display it on your computer. And then it likely caches it in case you go back again. But actually saving an email file, usually you have to do that yourself, you know,
right.
in a save as.
Right, which I never do. So it's just strange that all my emails are accumulating in EML files.
Yeah, that's weird.
You didn't by any chance export to EML at any point.
Do an export or a backup?
You know, or if you saved a message onto your computer at any point?
No, I don't do that. I either forward it to somebody or I delete it.
I don't honestly know that.
In order to do this on Yahoo, you're supposed to pay them some money to enable that to happen.
Yeah, apparently you win.
Well, the POP used to be free and IMAP you had to pay for, but since Apple started pushing the iPhone with Yahoo IMAP mail, IMAP is now free too. It may be an attachment to the message is getting downloaded to your computer in EML format.
No, this is not the attachments. This is just whatever I would see on the website. That's what goes into the
So if you open them up with a text editor, you can see them?
Yes.
Yeah, you're not... That's interesting.
That's very strange.
And all the help is how to create an EML, not why is it creating one.
Yeah.
Right. That's what we're seeing over here as well. I honestly don't know. You're using the webmail. You're not using Outlook or anything else.
I don't even have Outlook. I do have Windows 8, the mail program, but I hardly ever start it up.
Well, but if you do start it up, it will download all that mail.
Maybe that's what happened.
There you go.
What path are those EML files in?
I didn't notice. I wasn't looking for them. They just came up when I did a search on some other keyword, and there were the emails.
Well, and here's a second thing. Check that again through your startup folder, also MS config. Check to see whether or not your mail is starting up in the background.
There might be a mail helper that starts in the background, so it can count when you get a new mail without actually having your mail program running.
Right. If your system tells you you've got new messages, it's probably downloading them in the background.
It does not do that.
Okay. But check to make sure there's no helper app running.
Okay.
And certainly anytime you do start that up, it will then download the mail. Now, you can, in the easiest way to fix this is in the mail app, you should be able to set how long you keep old emails.
Okay. That's usually only in the trash, not in the inbox.
Maybe not.
But it may be that mail program has a helper running. Search for the EML file again and see what path they're in, and see if it's in something like local settings, data, Outlook, or whatever mail calls it now.
Right. Because what folder it ends up in, or subfolder, will tell you a lot about what program is downloading it.
Okay, I'll give that a try.
All right. All right, thanks. We have to take a break, I'm afraid. All right, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 42 minutes after the hour. You're listening to Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Soundbites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 46 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And, for those of you who's TweetDeck, on Wednesday, a newly discovered vulnerability in TweetDeck allowed attackers to remotely execute JavaScript code. Users reported pop-up windows reading, "Yo," or "Please close now, TweetDeck." Yes, it said, "Please close now, TweetDeck. It is not safe." Twitter took down all the versions of TweetDeck until the bug could be fixed, but has now restored the app, reporting that their fix is working as intended. Users are directed to log out of their accounts and log back in to activate the fix. When clients are left unpatched, the attacks let users execute their own JavaScript code elsewhere in the browser. So far, most of the reported exploits have been simple pop-up messages, but the potential does exist for more intricate attacks. The vulnerability is believed to be confined to web-based versions of TweetDeck, but other users have reported similar attacks in TweetDeck's Windows app. The vulnerability targets XSS, short for cross-site scripting, one of the most prolific sources of security flaws in web applications. Researchers have reported XSS vulnerabilities in TweetDeck in the past, most notably Mikko Hyponen in 2011, but developers reported the vulnerability as fixed almost immediately, and most believe that it is a closed issue. It's still unclear how the vulnerability resurfaced. One attack used the vulnerability to trigger TweetDeck's retweet command, causing any vulnerable client to automatically retweet the string to its followers. The result was the Twitter equivalent of a worm spreading from account to account. Many popular accounts were hit by the bug, like New York Times, Business, Salon, SF Gate, things like that. Still, as explained by Timothy B. Lee, the structure of TweetDeck means the bug can only work within TweetDeck's normal permissions, seriously limiting the potential fallout. So while the retweet worm wreaked havoc among social media managers, it appears to have left more sensitive data and infrastructure untouched. So do you use TweetDeck? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll free 1-800-790-0415.
And apparently there's the tweet that caused it all.
Right, it's got the heart on the end, and that heart is actually the cross-site scripting thing.
Yep.
For those of you who don't know, TweetDeck is a program that essentially runs in your browser, but also has app versions will let it. You set it up so that it does all kinds of interesting things for Twitter. Yeah. It's a more convenient way to use Twitter. The guy who did it, I believe, in German. It's not as...
Austrian.
Excuse me, Austrian. Because I can tell the difference.
Don't tell George that. He's in here. You know that. He's in the station.
I understand that.
Listening to this conversation.
George is listening, and I'm in trouble now. So much of it happened in Europe rather than here.
It wasn't a hack. It was some sort of accident, he said.
Yeah, I'm sure that's exactly what it was. It was a cross-site scripting thing, which is basically it pulls in JavaScript code usually from another website and runs it in your browser as if it came from the website you had originally gone to.
And he got it in 140 characters, which is the limit of a tweet?
Yeah, I think he must have. JavaScript is pretty good at that, and so I suppose he did. It's a pretty clever hack if you're into that sort of thing. But it was fixed awfully quickly, so I don't know that there's any real issue with that. Twitter is, I don't know anymore. I don't know anymore what the big social media platform is anymore. Maybe it's Tumblr now or Pinterest or one of those.
They're all kind of sort of merging into their own uses. Twitter seems to be for breaking news.
Yeah,
and Facebook is for connecting to people you don't want to connect to, and that's why I left college.
And Pinterest is for food.
Pinterest is for
food. And Tumblr
food,
is for things.
Things that we can't see here at the school.
And Reddit is for harder core things.
Yeah, yeah.
I kind of like the Ask Me Anythings on Reddit.
Sometimes Reddit is really interesting. Most of the time, you think, these people are lonely, and they need to learn to read a book.
Yeah. There's a reason why I don't go near Reddit.
Yeah.
It's because I'm afraid of what I'm going to find when I click on it.
Yeah.
Things you can't unsee.
Yeah.
Pretty much, yes.
Yeah, I don't look at Reddit very often either. Every time I get the urge to do so, I realize that I have been at the computer far too long and I'm now bored. It's time to get up and go do something real with my life. Well, so
Reddit's not blocked here.
That's weird.
Tumblr was, but Reddit's not.
Tumblr is. Facebook is.
What that is the people that are running that think, okay, well, we have all the obvious ones. Okay, what's a Reddit?
Yeah, right.
That's what they're doing.
Well, they look at Reddit and what you see across the top is like, cute animals and that stuff, and they're thinking, okay, how bad can it be? Yeah.
So that's supposed to be voted the highest. People vote for how good a story is to get it to the highest level,
right,
which is supposed to mean it's a good story until the jerks get along and rate high, something really bad.
Right. I do once in a while go to, is it Reddit that has Today I Learned?
What did I learn today? Seth Rogen and James Franco are going to assassinate Kim Jong-il in a new movie? No? No, just there's a Comedy Central roasted James Franco the other night.
Yeah, it's /r/ Today I Learned. That's actually kind of fun. That one I like. I will go there once in a while. There's always some fun things. Today I learned Noah Webster, the founder of Merriam-Webster, learned 26 languages in order to evaluate the etymology of words. And then they give you a site so that you can actually go
to confirm that.
Confirm that. Well, unless the site is Wikipedia.
FARC does that.
Yes. Yes, they link you to the real article.
Yeah.
That's assuming that it's not Wikipedia, because you really can't. Yep. You can trust Wikipedia for obscure stuff. Because, anything that hasn't been mentioned on Stephen Colbert or isn't political is probably okay.
Yeah. And the theory is if it gets put on Wikipedia, it will be self-edited correct by somebody. Then you get into an editing war by two people that are trying to edit it back to the way they wanted it.
That's why they often lock stuff. There's probably somebody at Wikipedia who watches Colbert just to lock whatever he's talking about right now.
Probably. It's like,
yeah.
I can almost guarantee you, between Colbert and probably anything mentioned on Fox News.
Yeah. 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 So, if you haven't used Reddit yet, REDDIT /r/ Today I Learned. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. There's some very interesting things in Reddit. There's a lot of stuff that isn't all that good.
Appropriate.
Panic grass at Yellowstone Park requires a soil temperature of 125 degrees Fahrenheit and a fungus and a virus to live.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right, that's it. We're done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in. Nobody's waiting on the line, so we don't have to apologize to anybody. I want to thank Michael Oden for stepping in at the last minute to replace Dave Enright, who missing in action. We'll find out what exciting thing he was doing next week. Steve Ray, thank you for showing up before the start of the show.
Yep.
Yeah, that was
as long
nice.
As you
yeah,
show
you.
Up before you say your name, you're on time. I'm Nick Francesco, and we are the longest-running computer show in the known universe. Don't go away. Some of the best German music you'll hear all week will be here
and maybe
with
some
George.
Of the worst, too.
And Michael will stay here in order to keep him on the straight and narrow. We'll be back next week with a whole lot more of Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Thanks for listening.